of that contextual understanding, and for the sake of the wider context in which we all live, our global church of the 21st century. This is where my own work has taken me in the last several years. I've just finished writing a book entitled Introduction to Theology in Global Perspective. It's just been published by Orbis Books, as Emma said, and it's part of the series of Theology in Global Perspective, edited by the Vietnamese-American theologian Peter Phan. The book is an attempt to introduce students to doing theology, a theology that is always contextual, but it draws on the wisdom of many theological voices from many different parts of the world. It is, as I describe it, a baby step in the direction of a global theology. But I think it is one in the right direction. Let me now conclude. We are at a new crossroads in the history of the church. Perhaps as important as the decision recorded in Acts 15 not to burden Gentile believers with Jewish culture and customs. Perhaps as important as when Constantine declared the rapidly growing Christian church a legal religion in the empire. Perhaps as important as when Luther nailed his 95 theses to the church door at Wittenberg. Perhaps as important as Europe's encounter with Americans, Asians, and Africans at the end of the 15th century. Perhaps as important as the evangelical revival in the English church in the 18th and 19th centuries. Contextual theology can help us deepen our appreciation of God's gift of our senses, our cultures, our genders, the circumstances of our lives. It can offer the church, perhaps for the first time in history, the gift of its multi-splendored identity, a new appreciation of its unity and Catholicity, its amazing holiness, and its roots in those who knew the Lord in his earthly ministry. What has contextual theology to offer the church of the 21st century? In a word, I think, it offers the church a new look at itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much for that wide-ranging and comprehensive talk. We have plenty of time for questions, so those people who would like to ask a question or make a comment, please do so. Philip.
Thank you again for a very stimulating presentation there.
Thank you.
I couldn't help then immediately reflecting on my own context. Mm-hmm. I won't try and bore everyone with, mm-hmm. but for those who don't know, my primary role at the moment is being a parish priest in a Catholic parish, mm-hmm. with the subsidiary role of being the diocesan director for the Pontifical Mission Societies. Mm-hmm. The thing that struck me about what you said is that I think I put your phrase there, on one hand contextual, on the other global and intercultural.
Yes, yes.
And on both sides of my present work, mm-hmm. in my parish, we decided to have some sort of international celebration and found 45 different language mm-hmm. groups mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. one parish,
right.
in a pretty bog-standard Hertfordshire market town, effectively.
Yeah.
And clearly, you know, my other hat in trying to raise animation about world mission
yes.
is the intercontextual interanimation between where we are in the UK and the church throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I try to say, well, where I am and what is mission,
mm-hmm.
it is that intercontextual,
yes.
mutual interanimation,
yes.
discovering of the new by discovering the different, which informs where one began.
That's right, yeah.
Which is why I was quite excited by towards your conclusions about
yes.
a new form of dialogue.
Yes.
Because it actually seems to me, if I were to define what my own work now is,
mm-hmm.
it's struggling and trying to provide a space for exactly that sort of dialogue to happen.
Yes, yes. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think our world is such. I mean, it's such a different world from, you know, as I said, you know, 100 years ago, 50 years ago. In a way, you know, as the American bishops, American Catholic bishops said at one point, you know, we're all sending countries. We're all receiving countries. You know, there's no such thing as, you know, us and them. You know, it's much more of a global reality. And while, you know, the temptation is perhaps to get stuck now in ourselves, I think our very multiculturality, internationality, and so forth needs to also focus on, you know, what is happening in other parts of the world as well. So it's a whole new context, I think, for mission. Absolutely.
Thank you very much again.
Thank
my
you.
Question, I would like to go back to what you said about the new dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and about this remark of this young Filipino theologian.
Yeah.
That she says that she writes her works only in her language,
right.
Because it's so local, so
yeah.
So contextual for,
mm-hmm.
for those people. And now I would like to ask maybe a little bit provocative question. Isn't she right when she thinks that if it's supposed to be for the local context,
mm-hmm.
If we bring it up on the global level,
yeah.
what could be the
maybe
platform for a dialogue? Because between this peculiar, between these unique theologies, because if we say that they should be maybe evaluated in the light of scripture and
mm-hmm.
the tradition
mm-hmm.
which is of the past. Don't we risk that the tensions and the peculiarities, the uniqueness will just disappear? Or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me, I'm not sure I could answer all of your question,
yeah.
but I think that whole issue of, you know, of Estela saying that, well, I can only write in my own language. I don't want this to be translated into, let's say, English or into Spanish or into, you know, German or whatever, you know, because it will ruin what I really want to say. It has to be said this way. I think she's absolutely right. And there's the, you know, there's the roots part of the contextual thing. But what that does, of course, is deprive the rest of us, you know, of the richness that she brings. But then the question is, well, you know, are we going to have, you know, is this another kind of neo-colonization, you know, by saying, well, it has to all be in English so everybody can understand it, you know, or in Spanish or whatever it is. This is, I think, a really big question, which I don't know the answer to. It might mean that some of us are going to have to, you know, it won't be German and French that, let's say, I had to, when I did my doctorate, I had to know German and French and Latin and Greek. It might be, you know, Kiswahili and Tagalog. And Syriac or something like that, you know what I mean? That may be, you know, the future of this, so that scholars like me can read the Estela Padillas, you know. So I don't know where this is going, but it is it's really frustrating to me, and at the same time it's really challenging to me. But I think we're at a new moment in theology, you know, that the future is not going to just be, you know, European or something like that, but it's going to be global, right? You know, and that all theology has to be done that way. But then, if that is true, then how do we get access to that? You know, and then I think our whole theological education may have to change in terms of languages and, you know, where we study, you know, the kind of work that we do, you know, this, you know, theological work that we do and so forth. You know.
Thank you.
Interesting.
I was very glad to hear that, because I was going to ask a question about whether there was an unconscious privileging of Western language in that desire for intercontextual theology.
Exactly.
But my other question was also about that work of the language of intercontextuality, whatever language that is in. Once that intercultural discourse starts to take place in people's second, third, fourth language, what effect will that actually have on the ability to do theology, to work in not just technical language but also poetic, not just, for example, when you're doing storytelling worldwide, you often root only into concrete examples of what you can share about things that can be seen and touched, and not into the abstract or the experiential or the spiritual aspects of that. So what effect does doing this work together have, and what do we lose in doing it?
Yeah, and I don't know. I think again, this is like a frontier, you know, that we're coming into. I mean, I will say that one of the great theological traditions of the world is all done in poetry and song, and that is the East Syrian tradition. You know, Bardason, Ephraim, people like that. You know, they wrote all this stuff in. I mean, they're all hymns. That's the theology, you know. I mean, I think we may be at a point, and I don't know. I mean, it's because we get into these. At least I get into these like boxes or perspectives where, where's the scholarship going to go? Where's the seriousness going to go? And maybe I don't know. Maybe that's ultimately not important. Maybe theology exists for the sake of communicating the gospel. Imagine that. and maybe the other will persist for sure, but maybe other things will come up. I mean, this is one of the problems that majority world scholars have with like Western academic institutions. You know, they don't do serious theology. You know, I was talking with a woman who teaches at Boston College in the United States, and Boston College is probably considered now the best Catholic theological faculty in the country, and she says that they're looking for a new systematic theologian. You know, not a Latino or an African American, someone with gravitas. You know, some of the seriousness. I mean, you know, it's that kind of mentality, because Latinos and African Americans don't do theology, with the usual suspects, you know. And I think that's the kind of thing. I mean, I don't know where we are. I mean, this is a real frontier, and I kind of mourn the passing of, you know, the world that I was brought up in, too. But on the other hand, I see the promised land, someplace else. But this is, I think, some of the stuff that could be happening, I hope will be happening, as contextual theology begins to be taken more seriously. Yeah.
Yes. Appreciate you for the clear talk. I come from a country where 80% of the population are Hindus.
Mm-hmm.
We live side by side with religious Hindus,
right.
Muslims, and doing contextual theology itself is a big challenge for us.
Yes.
Because the theological concepts have to be redone.
Yes.
But they have their own understanding of concepts like sin, salvation,
redemption,
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no one clear context to be a contextual.
Yeah.
So we are already facing a pluralistic cultural context.
Yeah.
So in that situation, what would you be your approach?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, and I don't know your context, and so it's always dangerous to talk. But I mean, I think this is the great challenge before us. You know, this is the great adventure of the 21st century and beyond. There's a lot of stuff that could be said. I mean, first of all, I think, you know, those many contexts, you know, need to be entered into by Christians, by the church. Christians have to also, you know, in their own communities and so forth, try to live the gospel as authentically as they can in those contexts and see what comes up, you know, see what comes out of that. But it is, again, it's kind of an unknown, I think. And this is, of course, what makes a lot of people nervous. What are we going to lose, you know, as we move in this direction? And I think one of the people who are most nervous is Pope Benedict XVI. I mean, I think he sees, you know, some of the issues here if we begin moving in this direction.
One area of challenge is the field of Christology.
Yes, yes.
It's a very big problem for us.
Yes, oh, yeah, it really is, yeah. But, you know, I'm convinced that if the gospel is universal, if it's not, you know, just a, what's the, you know, relativistic kind of thing, we'll find ways. You know, we'll find ways to talk and communicate and encounter and so forth. Yeah. But it is dangerous. But as Andrew Walls says in a wonderful article, he talks about how dangerous the Council of Nicaea was. You know, how dangerous it was to move beyond scriptural language to talk about Christ, you know, in the categories of Greek philosophy. Not only that, with a term that actually had been condemned as heretical, you know, 100 years before. And Wall says, I think, eloquently how every contextual theology has to learn how to take risks. You know, again, this is part of the tradition. The tradition takes risks, you know. And so to be part of that, you know, we have to learn to risk. We have to be very careful. You know, we have to be cautious, but we also have to, you know, enter into this.
John.
Thank you for your talk. I was fascinated by what you said about where we may be going in terms of the,
mm-hmm.
where the center of gravity and the character of church life will be in a few
mm-hmm.
decades'
yes.
time and how theology will reflect that. The notion of a Western university, many people would say, is that knowledge transcends context.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that a lot of Western universities work seems to be by plucking people out of their context and placing them in a context-free context for
yeah.
a few years.
Yeah.
How would you advise people who contribute to a theological faculty in a Western
yeah.
university?
Mm-hmm.
to deal with the fact that these institutions are largely founded on a notion that is rather cross-grained in relation to the way the wind of the Spirit may be blowing in the next
yes,
few decades.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, in a way, the modern university is a product of the Enlightenment, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the great example of Berlin, you know, that comes directly out of the Enlightenment and which has, you know, influenced so much of thought. I think one way is to recognize the context of these so-called context-free contexts. You know, they're not context-free, you know. There's a certain kind of knowledge, you know, and a certain kind of thinking that goes on. It's marvelous. I mean, I think it's absolutely marvelous. But it is not value-free. It is not context-free. So one step would be to recognize that. And I mean, I don't know how you do that, but I think in our, you know, in our writing and our talking and our in the alternative ways of educating and so forth, those of us who have, you know, some kind of insight into this, you know, that's one thing. I think as much as possible, you know, to get people to read in other contexts, to expose themselves to other contexts. You know, I mean, I think those of us who have been missionaries, you know, who have crossed cultures and struggled with this, I mean, we see this. We see this instinctively. You know, once you really try to bond with another culture and recognize, you know, the goodness and the validity of another culture. So this kind of exposure, I think would be possible. But I do think, I mean, it's a major task, you know, and because the development of the modern university has been such a marvelous thing, I think we are in another position now. I think we have to, you know, we have to move, or let's say we have to, what's the word? I don't know if sublate is the best word. Keep the best of this and move on, you know. But I think we do have to move on, and I think part of it would be to recognize, you know, the validity of other ways of knowing, other ways of thinking, other ways of being Christian, etc. It's a poor answer, but it's a big question.
John framed far more elegantly the kind of question.
I have to briefly say I'm a Christian and a Hindu family.
Uh-huh.
So interfaith dialogue goes on all the time.
It's
varying degrees of agreement, disagreement,
uh-huh.
compassion and criticism.
Right.
This happens. Having said that, I feel when the church fathers were doing contextual theology, as you quite rightly pointed out, they were taking risks.
Yes.
And they were also dealing with dangerous and difficult explorations.
Yes.
But they also had to establish some ways of control over this.
Yes.
To accord with the tradition and
yes.
the experience of the church.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so on.
Right.
My feeling from my experience of modern contextual theology of Asia and others, what
mm-hmm.
limited knowledge
mm-hmm.
of it, is we don't seem to have any particular, I wouldn't call it control, but any seem to guidance through this. There's, in other words, how do you tell bad contextual theology
mm-hmm.
from good
mm-hmm. yeah.
theology?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you stop it being
yeah.
simply trendy?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a great question, you know, I mean, even in the early church, you know who was a real good contextual theologian? It was Arius.
Yes.
Arius is a great contextual
yes.
theologian because he really interpreted Jesus in the light of Platonic philosophy. You know, and it was the Athanasius and the fathers of Nicaea, you know, who said, yes, you know, we have to move beyond the language of Scripture, but, you know, we have to also listen. This is the experience of the people. This is the experience of the church. You know, this is, you know, where God is really leading us. So contextual theology is not always right, as you say. And how do you move beyond the trendy? You know, how do you move beyond a false way? I mean, I think